One. This is Ronald O. Ostrander, 8803 D Road, Des Plaines, Illinois. Question two. I attended the University of Wisconsin between 1932 and 1935. My status, under question three, my status at the university was undergraduate, except for the last semester when I had the status of a graduate student. Question four. I graduated from the Montevideo High School, Montevideo, Minnesota, in 1930. Question five, I decided to attend North Dakota State College because my father, who was a locomotive engineer, was going to work out of Fargo at that time. Question six, I decided to transfer to the University of Wisconsin in the fall of 1932. My father had been killed in a train wreck in January of that year, and under question seven, I believe that the University of Wisconsin compared most favorably, particularly in the School of Chemical Engineering, with any other school in the country, and later accurate evaluations of its standing showed that the University of Wisconsin School of Chemical Engineering was the best in the country. Under question eight, when I left for college, I carried just one suitcase full of clothes. No books, no phonograph, and definitely no automobile. Question nine. I traveled to North Dakota State College and then 2 years later to the University of Wisconsin at Madison by train because my father had been a locomotive engineer. I had pass privileges on the railroads until I finished school. Under question 12, I did have orientation from the dean of the College of Engineering, and that was a rather interesting session that I had with him. I recall that he asked me if I was related to the great Ostrander oarsman at Cornell. And from his description of that oarsman, I presume he was about as powerful as my father, who was outstanding in his day. Under question 14, I decided to pursue the course of chemical engineering, and I made that decision on my way to Fargo, North Dakota in 1930. On the train, I made the acquaintance of another student who was following the course of chemistry. And in our discussions, he said that chemical engineering was the toughest course, and I had decided that my course would be either in engineering or chemistry, and I liked the challenge, so I did decide to go for chemical engineering, and I have not regretted that decision. Under 15, it seems to me that students were expected to be neat in class, but there was no dictation as to what dress they used or wore. The male engineering students were inclined to wear cords and sweaters. jackets in colder weather. The women engineering students wore skirts and blouses and coats. Under question 16, the professors generally wore suits. Under question 17, it seems to me that students were just expected to behave in class with proper decorum and pay attention to the instructor or professor, and that was it. Under question 18, I don't believe that there were any serious discipline problems in class, that most of the students in engineering were there to try to learn what they could from engineering. I know this was definitely my idea, that the only one who would be a loser if I didn't learn would be me. And this is the point that I have tried to make to younger students today, that the only loser, if they miss something in class, will be they themselves. Under question 19, their classes were generally co-ed, although the percentage of female students, women students, and engineering classes was probably as low as 10% of the total. And I believe that the women were treated the same in terms of course expectation and access to materials as the men students. Under question 20, the average class, I believe, was about 20, either in class or in labs. At this point, I think I should digress a bit from the format of the questionnaire and point out that I did live in Wisconsin during my youth from 1920 through 1927. In 1922, we moved to Wisconsin Dells, and there at the age of 10, I immediately began working as a guide in the Dells, because at that time there were no regulations about age for that sort of work. When I was 15, there was a law passed that one did have to be 15 to work on the river. But that enabled me to continue to do so. In 1927, my family moved to Montevideo, Minnesota, but they allowed me to return each summer to the Dells to work through the summer, because it was a job that paid very well. Actually, I did not receive any salary, but made money from selling guidebooks to the tourists. Actually, I was able to save about $200 a month during a time when gold was $20 an ounce. And that was more than my starting pay as an engineer when I graduated in 1935. In fact, 1935 was a very difficult year, and to the best of my knowledge, I was the only one in the class to get a job that year. So the money that I made at the Dells was the big factor in enabling me to continue with my education. I would like to go ahead to question 41 and discuss the professors who had great influence on me. Professor Kowalki, who was chairman of the department at the time, was outstanding, as were Professors Olaf Haugen and Roland Ragatz, who later assumed chairmanship of the department. I believe that these outstanding educators were the most important factor in making the School of Chemical Engineering the best in the country. I also had some very fine professors in statics and dynamics, Professors Maurer and Withy. And I greatly enjoyed taking organic chemistry under Professor Fisher. I recall that in that large auditorium where he gave his lectures on organic chemistry, that when he walked in and peered up at us through his thick glasses, we would give him a skyrocket. And he would stand there with a slight smile on his face until the sound died out. And then, for the rest of the 50 minutes, he would pour out organic chemistry at us as faster than we could assimilate it. He had two assistants to erase what he put on the blackboard, and he went across that platform just putting down formulas as fast as he could write, and most of us couldn't keep up with him, but we tried our hardest. But it was a very interesting and challenging course. Industrial chemistry calculations under Professor Haugen was another very challenging course. My good friend and fellow student, Herman Herrig, and I frequently worked together in our nights working on the problems that Professor Haugen assigned to us. I can remember one in particular, a design of a continuous dryer of hides on which we worked very many hours, and I believe that Herman and I were the only ones that came up with a final answer to that design problem. But it was a very difficult and time-consuming problem. My days at the university were jam-packed with activity, and it was a matter of being on the go continuously from early morning until late at night. It was fortunate that I had good health and lots of stamina, because I only had about 4 to 5 hours each night that I could be in bed. For many years, I thought that I got along with that much sleep. And then one day it occurred to me that I just didn't remember. I didn't know how much I slept in class. I had a professor in electrochemistry who droned, and I think it did put me to sleep. When he would see me asleep, he would ask a question and then say, "Ostrander," on which I would become alert with a momentary feeling of panic, but then from the subconscious I realized what the question was, and since I was an A student, I had the answer. And I could see that the professor was becoming more and more annoyed with me as the year went on, because he knew I was asleep and still that I had the answer. Many years later, I read of experiments that were conducted with students where they, when they were sleeping, they had earphones and taped lessons. And then they were tested later to see whether they retained anything that was run on the tapes while they were asleep. And it was surprising to the experimenters to find that they retained very much of it. And when I read this, I chuckled and said, "That's funny, I knew it all along." 30 years after graduation, I went back to Engineers Week at Madison, and after the final banquet at the end of the week in the Great Hall of Memorial Union, I asked another professor if I could look if Professor Haugen was at the dinner, and he pointed to the far corner of the room and said I'd find him over there. As I made my way through the crowd and I got about 20 feet away from him, he saw me coming, and a warm smile lit his face, and he said, "Why, Ronald?" And then he turned to his wife and introduced me as Mr. Ostrander. I was amazed. Of course, I realized that Professor Haugen probably did look over the list of those who were returning, but I was amazed that he recognized me. Obviously, I changed more over the years than he did, and because he had weathered the years so well that he did not look a great deal older. About 11 years ago, I had the very great pleasure of calling on and chatting with Professor Kowalke in his home there in Madison. He was an amazing man, and still very vigorous and alert at an advanced age. I don't recall what his age was, but I think he was in his late 80s at the time. As I said earlier in this recording, my life in Madison was led at a very fast pace, with classes, work at some job, athletics, and study and problems. This kept me going for many hours of the day and until late at night, so that I could only get in 4 or 5 hours of sack time each night, and had to pop out of bed and go off at a fast pace again the next day. Fortunately, my health was good enough to be able to do this, and part of that came from the fact that I did spend part of that time, engaged in athletics, including football and boxing at Wisconsin. I did take a crack at crew too, but I soon realized that the crew coach thought that I was too heavy to be a crew man. He liked them under 180 pounds, and I weighed in at 202. Since I transferred to Wisconsin in my third year of college, I had to play freshman football the first year, and I was somewhat disappointed on transferring to Wisconsin to find that Dr. Clarence Wiley Spears had been hired as the head football coach. He was also the head football coach at the University of Minnesota when I was going through high school there, and I concluded at that time that he was not as good a football coach as my high school coach. And I think that his record at Wisconsin shows that he did not coach in an imaginative manner. And actually, in the fall of 1932, when I was playing freshman football, Mickey McGuire was the quarterback for the Wisconsin team. And in the days of limited substitution, he had to call all the plays. They couldn't be sent in from the sidelines. And since he did do an excellent job of running the team, he probably gave Spears a couple more years on the job before he lost it. During my 2 years at North Dakota State, I was living at home, and therefore I was able to afford to belong to a fraternity. When I transferred to Wisconsin after the death of my father, I could no longer afford this. At North Dakota State also, I had time to engage in other extracurricular activities besides sports. I played football there, was a boxer. I sang with the men's glee club and also in the mixed chorus, and had leading parts in the production of the Bison Brevities, as they were called. Even though I did save $600 every summer at the Wisconsin Dells, and when in the days when gold was $20 an ounce, it was necessary for me to work in addition during the school year to be able to get through. So my activities at Wisconsin were pretty much limited to sports besides my work and classes and studies. For the 1932-33 school year, I lived in a private home on Washington Street. The second year, 33-34, I lived in Adams Hall, one of the two men's dormitories on the lake at that time. They were the original ones. And in 34-35, I had a room in what had been a fraternity house on the hill close to Camp Randall. There were six of us who had rooms there, and we had the use of a kitchen where we prepared our own meals to keep the cost down. During my year at Adams Hall, I had a job which took care of paying for my meals. At first, I waited on table for a short period of time, but then they came the opportunity to work after the meal, work faster and harder and for a shorter period of time. That was unloading the dumb waiter with the clean dishes that came up from the washroom. So I was pleased to get that job because I could go to it later. Now, there have been some questions about whether we were required to dress formally for dinner. We were not. As I recall, there were eight students to a table, and the meals were served by other students, as I did at the start of the year. There's a question, too, about the fellows at the dormitory. I don't recall the last name of our fellow. I recall his first name was John, and he was a med student, and I found him to be very interesting and became a good friend during the year that I was at Adams Hall. While living at Adams Hall, in the spring of 34, I had the rather rare occasion to have just enough time to have a date. And it happened to be with a very beautiful co-ed from St. Joseph, Missouri. Her name was Lois Bell McKee. And as was popular then, we spent that evening up on Observatory Hill. After I took her back to her home and returned to Adams Hall, I found that the boys in the dormitory were all agog because Paul Whiteman had introduced a song on the national radio entitled When It's Dark on Observatory Hill, and said that it had been written by the song had been composed by his drummer, who had become familiar with the fact that there was an Observatory Hill while playing at the Chanticleer. Well, that song never did become very popular because it was not an easy song to sing. But it had its memories for me, and I did make a point to learn the song. And even though I don't do much singing these days and I don't keep my voice in good trim, I will try to render the song as I remember it. When it's dark on Observatory Hill, come on, let's pretend we're Jack and Jill. We'll climb to the hilltop where college sweethearts go. We'll look on the lights on the campus down below. We'll learn what astronomy is for, and we'll learn what the stars may have in store. My heart tells me this, your lips were meant to kiss when it's dark on Observatory Hill. Oh, I'd like to recite you a poem that I wrote. It tells why I think you're wonderful. And from afar you can hear a sweet guitar. The voices are harmonizing. You don't need to know arithmetic just to figure why you and I should click. We'll know in advance the moon will mean romance when it's dark on Observatory Hill. Although I lived in the dormitory for only 1 year, I will try to answer some of the questions 43 through 51. In retrospect, I think it was a good decision that I did live in Adams Hall for 1 year because I found it to be an enjoyable experience. I did not have any roommates. I had a single room. And I there made the acquaintance of Herman Herrig because he also lived in a dormitory, and he was a very fine student, one of the top ones in chemical engineering. In fact, I think he and I had the top grade point averages in the school. And we found it enjoyable to work together on big and long problems. As I said a little earlier, my house fellow was named John and was a medical student. And he was a very fine young man, and I found him to be interesting, and I became a friend of his. His role, I think, was to supervise the house and make sure that things did not get out of hand. College students do have a tendency to get a bit boisterous at times, and John allowed a certain amount of that, but also kept the thing within limits. As far as a typical dinner at the dorm, we were not expected to dress for dinner. We dressed as we normally would for school. As I said, the tables usually had about, as I recall, 8 seated to a table, and the tables were, of course, in rows in each direction in the dining room. Topics, of course, included many things. Athletics, school, girls, of course. Food was wholesome, good, an adequate amounts of it, and as a football player and boxer, I burned up a lot of calories every day, and I usually found that after football practice I'd be so dehydrated that I would toss off about a quart of milk before dinner and drink another quart with my meal. As far as the housing employees are concerned, I can't recall any of them in particular. Of course, I was only in the dormitory for the 1 year. During the last year, when I lived off campus in what had been a fraternity house on the hill close to Camp Randall Stadium, I also had a single room, and 5 other students and I had the use of a kitchen where we prepared our meals. The room was furnished. We prepared our meals in the kitchen with an assignment of duties, with one of the 6 doing the shopping. A couple of others were usually the cooks, and others cleaned up after the meal. It worked out quite well. I will say, looking back on it, that we bought nothing but the cheapest cuts of meat and so forth, so that our budget would stretch. Furthermore, because of the greater calorie consumption that I had to have because of my activities, why I had to buy other food in addition to what was bought by the group, particularly additional milk. I often think I probably was the best individual customer that the Wisconsin dairy industry had. On first reading question 63, I chuckled because it just seemed as though there was no free time while I was at Wisconsin. I was too busy. But on thinking it over more, I realized I did have occasional free moments. At question 65, I didn't spend a great deal of time at the Memorial Union, but it did play an important part in one social event. I was finance chairman of the military ball, and it was a very successful military ball. We promoted the fact that we brought Freddie Martin west of the Allegheny Mountains for the first time, and we did have an excellent turnout for the ball at a time when not many students had enough money to buy tickets. In addition to Freddie Martin, we had a second band, a very good band, the Red Nickels and His Five Pennies, as it was called, that played in the other ballroom. It was kind of interesting, too, that the bands wanted their payment in cold, hard cash before they left for the evening. So as finance chairman, I had to carry all that money on me during the ball. It didn't bother me a great deal, but it was a lot of money at that time. I don't recall just how much it was, but of course that was when gold was still only $20 an ounce. During the years I was on campus, I believe all students, women, Greeks, independents, ethnic, religious, and political minorities, had equal access to the memorial unions and to other buildings on the campus. I don't recall that there was any great problem in this respect. Under 67, I just don't recall what the fads and hobbies that were popular during your college years, or just what books everyone was reading. I know I was too busy to read books for pleasure. I had to stay with the books that were part of my studies. Under questions 68, 69, and 70, I just don't have any definitive answers for any of those. I did read the Daily Cardinal. My perceptions of the Cardinal was that it was a liberal publication, as we would call it today. In fact, I considered it rather radical. It seems to me that the lawyers and media people were that type, and we engineers were obviously at odds with them. I believe that competent engineers and other scientists were inclined to leave the political arena to the lawyers and other political types and devote themselves to advancing the productivity of our society. Perhaps this was somewhat of a mistake, because the liberals today have twisted our society to where it no longer is a society in which the productivity is rewarded and sloth penalized. It has just become the reverse, and this is one of our the most serious problem of our country today. In reference to question 73 on the prevailing student attitudes regarding alcohol, I think that large portion of the student body considered that it was a lot of fun to have a few beers, very little in the way of anything harder than that. While many of them, including myself, just didn't indulge. Tobacco, I would say the same. Drugs, just seemed to me that there was no problem with drugs other than tobacco and alcohol. And the attitude towards sex, of course, was much more restrained than apparently it is today. Under question 74, my parents did not have any expression of views on the social lives of the college students in general and UW students in particular, or on the politics of the college students. Under question 75, intramural sports were popular on the campus, but I was personally involved only in interscholastic sports, as I said earlier, in football and boxing. I was involved in track in high school, but didn't consider myself good enough at any track event to continue with. Under question 76, I think that football was the most popular of the major spectator sports, followed by basketball and track. In under question 77, Wisconsin was not considered a national power in any of those sports, but was somewhat of a Big Ten power in all three. Under question 78, in the football season of fall of 1932, Mickey McGuire was a prominent athlete on the campus, and in that football season, he led the Badgers to a season in which they lost one game by a score of 7-6, tied another game, and won all the rest. And I attribute a large portion of this to the intelligent play calling of Mickey McGuire himself. This, you must remember, was in the days of limited substitution, where a player could only go into the game once in each half. So they played both ways, and it was almost impossible for the coach to send plays in, and Mickey McGuire ran the team in an intelligent fashion with intelligent play calling. It just so happened, as I said earlier on this tape, that Dr. Clarence Wiley Spears came to Wisconsin that fall as head football coach. After McGuire graduated the following spring, he did not have a quarterback of his play calling ability, and the team's record dropped precipitously. I think that the success that the team had with McGuire at the helm was a big factor in Spears holding the job for a few more years. Going back to question 77, during my first year at Wisconsin, Fred Swan was the boxing coach, and he was also the freshman football coach. While I was there, the university hired Johnny Walsh to become the boxing coach while he was attending law school. And under Johnny Walsh, Wisconsin did become a national power in boxing, winning national title year after year. Johnny Walsh was a very unusual athlete. He was a 135-pounder, which put him in lightweight class, but he was about 5'10", which meant that he was very slender. But I believe he also had the fastest hands of any boxer, including any professional that I have ever seen. His hands were actually quicker than the eye, and I have seen him in the ring with other boxers, and you'd hear the pow and see his opponent's head snap, and you knew he had been hit. But neither the spectators nor the opponent ever saw the punch. It was that fast. It's rather interesting that while at North Dakota State College, I did go to the Twin Cities for the Northwest Golden Gloves, and I didn't see Johnny Walsh at that time. He was in another dressing room, and the defending lightweight champion for the Golden Gloves was in my dressing room, and I saw him go up for his bout with Johnny Walsh before I went up for my last bout. And when he came back, he was an obviously beaten man. But I didn't see Johnny Walsh personally for another 2 years. I have seen Johnny Walsh at 135 pounds get in the ring and spar with Champ Siebold, who was 6'4" and 256 pounds. Tape when it ran out. Johnny Walsh was such an excellent boxer that he could get in the ring with Champ Siebold, who was 6'4" and 256 pounds, outweighing Johnny by over 120 pounds. And he just could not touch Walsh. Walsh could block or slip all of his punches and give Siebold a boxing lesson. He wouldn't get in the ring with me because he knew I would punch to the body and that he couldn't slip or block completely, even though I was much smaller than Siebold. Under Johnny Walsh, because he was such an excellent boxer, the Wisconsin boxing team did become the national power, winning the national title year after year. They had some very fine boxers there while I was there. As I recall, Pete Zinda from Lilly, known as the Wild Man of Lilly, was in the 156-pound class, I believe, and during my last year, we had a match with the University of Syracuse, who were then the defending national champions. And Pete was fighting a defending national champion. But he beat him so very decisively that there was just no contest. Pete was what you'd call almost a perpetual motion boxer, just not worrying about defense at all, but throwing so many punches that his opponent couldn't get a punch in because Pete always beat him to the punch. He would come out of his corner and start punching and keep it up for about 30 to 40 seconds and then jump back a couple of steps and take a look at his opponent and then go back right back at it again for the rest of the round. The year before Johnny Walsh came to Wisconsin as boxing coach, he brought his team from St. Thomas University, which he was coaching as an undergraduate, to Wisconsin for a team match. And because the St. Thomas University did not have a boxer in the 145-pound class, and Wisconsin had Costa Rubini, who had been selected as a fighting as fighter in that class, and the school was desirous of having somebody box Rubini. Walsh agreed to give away 10 pounds and went in against Rubini. Even though Rubini was a slugger with very great reach, he was unable to touch Walsh throughout the fight. Walsh stood flat-footed, blocking his punches and slipping them, and every now and then you'd hear a pow and you'd see Rubini's head snap, and you realize that Walsh had thrown one of his faster than the eye can see punches, and it was a crowd-pleasing bout. In the fall of 1932, I was playing left guard on the freshman team, and just alongside me playing left tackle was Champ Siebold, a tremendous athlete who was 6'4" and 256 pounds and very agile. It was a lot of fun playing alongside the champ because I could concentrate completely on the men in front of me, knowing that the end would never sideswipe me, because the first thing that champ did when the ball was snapped was to reach out and flatten that end. He was so agile that he, in full football uniform, could sit on the ground, roll back onto his shoulder, and kip up onto his feet. However, Champ was not a good student, and he did not get through the first semester, and he returned the next year and tried again, but just couldn't make the grade scholastically. I presume today, somehow, with tutoring and so forth, they would have found some way to make Champ, a player of Champ's caliber, eligible. But that, of course, is something that I question the value of. It seems to me that intercollegiate athletics should be played by students, not by paid athletes who do not really qualify as college students. As I said earlier on this tape, the fall of 1932 was a very good year for football at Wisconsin. It is my recollection that we lost one game by a score of 7-6, tied one game, and won all the rest of them. And I attribute the fine performance of the team a great deal to the abilities of Mickey McGuire, an Irish Hawaiian who played in the backfield and ran the team on the field. Of course, this was in the days of limited substitution, when a player could only go in once each half, so he had to play both ways, and there was practically no way for the plays to be sent in from the sideline. They had to be decided upon by the quarterback running the team on the field, with the possible assistance of other members of the team that were on the field with him. The following year, after McGuire had graduated, the team's record was not good at all, and it only took a couple more years of that, and Dr. Spears was fired as football coach. I was discussing this tape with my daughter, who just graduated a year ago from business administration, and I was saying that it was a bit difficult for me to remember some of the teachers and professors and instructors that I had in the early 30s. And she remarked that she couldn't remember the one she had just had. And I think that this is probably due to the fact that I was blessed with having such fine professors when I was at Madison in the early 30s. I look back on it and I recall about 15 years ago, I was talking to Jim Cherwinka, who runs the Wausau Chemical Company and graduated not long before that. And I was remarking about what fine professors Kowalke, Haugen, Raggetz, Maurer, Withy, and Fisher were. And Jim stopped me and said, "To me, those are just the names of the men who wrote the books." Well, once again, it made me realize that I had the good fortune to learn from such fine, gifted professors. The professors Maurer and Withy taught statics and dynamics. Of course, Kowalke, Haugen, Raggetz were all either chairman or at the time of the Department of Chemical Engineering or later after I left. Dr. Fisher was my professor in organic chemistry. And there was one other course which I found very fascinating, and that was I was able to squeeze in an elective of the course on Man and Nature by Dr. Otto. This was a course which had such a backlog of those students desiring to take it that it had to be limited, even though it was he gave his lectures in the Bascom Theater, and as I recall, there were about 500 in the class. I recall having an early morning class under Professor Kowalke, and on this particular morning, as winter was setting in and a strong cold front had moved in from the north, the water of Lake Mendota was still much warmer than the air, and the vapors coming off the lake were condensing as the cold air hit them, so that there was a lot of vapor over the lake. And Professor Kowalke asked us if any of us had noticed that the lake was smoking that morning, and it seemed like everybody else in the class was still not quite awake, but I raised my hand to indicate that I had noticed the effect, and Professor Kowalke asked me to explain what was the cause of it, and of course it's relatively simple. The water was warm, and its vapor pressure was such that it struck air where the temperature of the air was well below the dew point of that water vapor in the air just above the water surface. I recall with some pleasure also one night Herman Herrig and I took a canoe that had been rigged up for sailing out onto Lake Mendota when the wind was very strong, blowing in from Picnic Point towards the dormitories. The waves were rolling up to about 2 foot height, and we would tack the canoe out against the wind until we got out opposite the end of Picnic Point, and then we would turn around and have a fast run in toward shore. Because I was 50 pounds heavier than Herman was, I served as a ballast. And to keep that canoe from tipping over, much of the time, about 90% of my body was outside of the canoe, with just the one leg from the knee down and one arm from the elbow down inside the canoe and the rest of my body outside to keep it balanced against the wind. And of course, there was nothing else to keep that canoe from tipping over in the wind, because all it was equipped with was some sideboards to serve as stabilizers. It seemed when we were running with the wind in toward shore that the canoe was going so fast it felt like it was almost going to take off and become airborne. My summertime job experiences at Wisconsin Dells, where I worked as a guide, were both interesting and financially rewarding. In those days, the path at the Stand Rock Landing led right up on top, where the dog now makes the jump from the main rock over onto the top of Stand Rock. In those days, I always made the jump for the tourists that were on my boat. And each trip, I would make the jump several times so that everybody that with a camera who was interested in getting a picture could do so. Some of them sent me pictures, and I have them in my album to this day. Some were taken from below near the base of Stand Rock, and some were taken from up on top. When I said that the work was financially rewarding, it was rather amusing that I started out work in 1935 after graduating as an engineer at a base salary of $125 a month. Of course, the value of the dollar was such then that gold was $20 an ounce, and so that would have been about 6.25 ounces of gold. And on the basis of the value of gold today, that was good starting pay. I believe I was the only one in the class to get a job that year, because it was a very difficult year. However, at the Dells, because the money I made was not in the form of a salary at all, but just the profit that I made from selling guidebooks to the tourists on my boat, I was able to pay my expenses and save $200 a month. And this was almost enough to get me through the 9 months of the school year. During the more than 48 years that have elapsed since I graduated from Wisconsin, there have been some sweeping changes in education and attitudes towards education in this country. The idea that everyone deserves advanced education is a laudable one, but doesn't always prove out to be the best. As a result, students are given high school diplomas who really don't qualify. They are allowed to matriculate at colleges and universities when they have to be given remedial courses in reading and writing. And as I mentioned earlier, there is such a desire to have winning teams in sports that we end up with many of the players not as really qualified students. I mentioned a little earlier on this tape that my daughter graduated a year ago. At times, while she was an undergraduate, she was paid well to tutor athletes. Well, I presume that Champ Siebold, or one of his type today, would probably become eligible to play, even though he might not have the ability to really pass an exam. Well, as I said too, I think that college sports should not be operated in such a way as to win at all costs. They should be played by student athletes, not ones who are just trying to pave their way into a professional career. I do believe that if our educational system would return to the idea of quality rather than quantity, we might be much better off. Excellence is the thing to strive for, and we can't have that if we give high school diplomas to students who can't read and write properly, allow them to matriculate in our colleges and universities, and then have to give them remedial courses before they can go on at that college or university, and still are going to have difficulty throughout their college careers. I recall a few years ago that one college in New York was even considering elimination of exams because the exams were discriminatory. Well, that's what they're supposed to be. They're supposed to bring out the differences between the gifted student and those who are not trying so hard. So, this, of course, is an extreme. That same university was allowing entrance without qualifications. Apparently, the push was to give a degree without qualifications, too. Going back to question 104, I'm not sure that my career goals were very lofty ones. I would say that primarily my goal was to be a competent chemical engineer, and I think I was quite successful in attaining that goal. Prior to World War II, working for the Procter & Gamble Company, I developed processes which I believe are still in profitable operation to this day. I developed the process of flash drying of soap for them, and also the continuous ivory bar process. The ivory bar had been made by the original process from it until the late 1930s, when I developed the continuous ivory bar process, which was of course, integrated with the flash drying of soap. It gave a bar of an entirely different quality than the old batch process that had been used up to that time. When I returned from World War II, I was assigned as project engineer for the development of the Tide process. Now, this was a crash program because the company was not sure whether any other company had gone into the production of or the development of a phosphate-built laundry detergent. And so the project was a crash program to make sure that we would be first on the market. As it turned out, nobody else was in the race, and the Tide project was one of the few, the Tide process, I should say, was one of the few in the detergent industry that was ever protected by patents. At the time that it came into operation, Procter & Gamble was actually second place amongst the big three of the detergent industry, with Lever Brothers first and Colgate-Palmolive third, a close third. I believe that the success of the Tide project, in which all the other competing brands had to pay Procter & Gamble for the patent rights to phosphate-built detergents, was the big factor in vaulting P&G from its second place position to its position of dominance, where it is now over twice as big as the other two companies put together. Today, there has been a drive to ban phosphate-built detergents from use. And this is a ill-considered drive. The phosphate detergents are so useful and absolutely not a factor, at least not a serious factor, in the eutrophication of lakes and streams. It is my estimate that the phosphorus from the phosphate detergents is less than 2% of the total in the phosphate cycle. Even the phosphorus from human waste is probably five times as much as it would be from phosphate detergents, even if the phosphate detergents are used to excess. If they are used, as I recommend, or at the most efficient low concentration, the phosphate detergents contribute only one-tenth as much as human waste do. Human waste, too, are still a small part of the total. Animal waste and decaying plant life are much more important factors. So, I would say that I was successful in reaching the goals that I sought. I will have to say that I was paid a good salary for developing the Tide project. Unfortunately, I did not share in the profits. Over the past dozen years, I have tried to spend as much of my spare time as possible in combating the efforts of the environmentalists to ban phosphate detergents. It is unfortunate that there is no satisfactory substitute for the phosphate-built detergents in laundering. The banning of the phosphate detergents will cost every family several hundred dollars annually. The actual amount will depend upon, of course, the value of the clothes that they launder. And of course, even a pair of jeans today, if the tensile strength of the fabric is weakened rapidly by the laundry detergent, it can be costly, because even pairs of jeans are now fairly costly. But it is true that the non-phosphate detergents can cause a 20% loss of tensile strength over a dozen launderings, where phosphate detergents will probably cause less than 2% loss of tensile strength. Furthermore, the non-phosphate detergents will also damage the washing machine itself and require repairs and replacements that would not be necessary if phosphate detergents were used. In trying to combat this banning of the phosphate detergents, over the past dozen years, I have appeared on CBS Morning News giving the message. I have also appeared on television programs in Cleveland and Dallas and Chicago and all over the state of Wisconsin. And numerous articles have been written on the subject in which my views have been expressed. And I have also given testimony on this before a congressional committee. Harold Scarlett of the Houston Post, in his column, wrote that my testimony was about the most fascinating and revealing as any heard before Congress since the late Joseph Valachi spilled the inner secrets of the mafia. Well, I realize that Harold is a rather flamboyant writer, but it was pleasant for me to read it. I still hope that this ban of phosphate detergents in Wisconsin will be lifted soon.